So now we're going to hear from David Rosenblatt. David joined the group in 1974. His talk is on vitamin B12, new tricks from an old vitamin. No kidding.
New tricks from an old doc.
Whoops. I might. So first of all, it's a really quite moving for me to be here. I can't start with my conception as Eric did. But in 1967, I was a 21-year-old colleague of Abe Fuchs in the combined BSc-MD program. And my uncle, Bill Gavsey, was a pediatrician in Montreal. He said, there's this real hotshot at the Montreal Children's Hospital in the name of Charles Scriber. If you can get into his lab for the summer, it would be a wonderful way to you to get a heads up on your career. And he made a call to Dr. Scriber, and Charles graciously accepted me for the summer. And he had me working for Richard Goldblum for a while, doing statistics on a cohort of patients with cystic fibrosis on one of these old adding machine calculators, doing means and standard deviations of, you know, cohorts of 200 and 300 samples, you know, to spend like a day getting the mean and standard deviation to show you how things have changed. And he also put me on a wonderful project to look at heterogeneity in PKU because they had been noticed of some sort of variation among the patients, which ended up to be a paper in Nature. So again, it's been all downhill since then. But in coming back to this, you know, celebration of the group structure has changed over the year, and as has been mentioned by Charles, with great generosity from Rod McGinnis and David Coleman and the faculty and the children's and various places, we're actually going to do a formal history of the group in two contexts, not only the people in the group, but how the group structure has fostered the advancement of science and how the group structure has changed. And at the beginning, Charles would say that the group is more than the sum of its parts. And in fact, that was true because the whole group grant was judged as a unit. Each grant didn't have to be independently financed. So it could be true that someone's individual contribution maybe wouldn't have been rated high enough, but when you look at its contribution to the other people in the group, it allowed the group to continue. And that structure changed later. But it really cocooned me for the first 10 years of my career and gave me sufficient time to accumulate patients. And as like Clark says, I would still write a grant today if I had a choice in the CHR, saying I will see what interesting clinical material comes across my desk, gather them statistically, characterize them and phenotype them properly, and see what new genes and new biology will come from that. And I hope that we'll show you very briefly that we've been able to do that, but you can't get funded to do that. Now, fortunately, I'm funded for 5 years, so I can say that's what I would have written in my grant other than what I wrote. So, Rob McGinnis talked to the graduate students and fellows this morning. He says, pick something that's important to work on. And Goldstein and Brown, too, were advised by Metelsky, pick on something that's important. You know, says, don't work on trivial problems. Well, megaloblastic anemia at the beginning of the 1900s and the end of the 1800s was like a kiss of death. This was a disease that caused death. And with the discovery of vitamin B12 and the discovery that one could treat megaloblastic anemia with vitamin B12, patients were cured and it no longer was a lethal disease. A wonderful advance. And we forget the huge advances in basic nutrition of the last century that really has changed the lives of millions of people. So the other model I like, I like to show this stamp of Dorothy Hodgkins, who was, I think, the second Nobel Prize winner in the area of vitamin B12, just to show you that it was at one time considered an important area and worthy of my entire career. But I'd also like to show Dorothy Hodgkins because I also like to look at both our group and our department of human genetics now of good examples of women in science and the model of women in science. I think we have well over 50% maybe women in our department, I think, on count. And we certainly have women in positions of leadership, both at the university, at the, on the group, and at the research institutes. And I think that this is, you know, being the father of daughters, I think this is a wonderful model that we should keep in front of us and put that in front of our students. But I also put this up because I was asking Dean Fuchs at the beginning of this talk to tell me what was the most cited article by any investigator at McGill. I don't know the answer. But I know that an article by Dr. Guida, when he worked with Henry Friesen on prolactin and the assay, was highly cited in the current contents when there was such a thing of current contents, cited as a, sort of a citation scholar article or something. And it's not, it's cited 870. I looked at Phil Gold's and Sam Friedman's article on CEA, and it's cited about 1,800 times. Rima Rosen's article with Phyllis Frost, which was a master's project, I believe, looking at the you know, the first description of the 677-CDT polymorphism in MTHFR, which has now gone to be used in many population studies, has been cited 2,686 times, which is, you know, I defy someone to find someone at McGill whose article has been cited more than that. So with that as a brief introduction, I'm going to thank Natasha Anastasio for doing everything that's good on these slides and nothing that's bad. And she put out the B12 landscape from, say, 30 years ago. And Roy was actually involved with this because he was working with one of the pioneers in the area, Leon Rosenberg at Yale, who sort of mapped out sort of the first genetic disorders with Hunt Willard and others, and developed some of the assays and complementation that I was later able to adopt. But basically, we knew that vitamin B12 in man was really required for two disorders, two enzyme reactions, only the conversion of methylmalonyl-CoA to succinyl-CoA in the mitochondria and the conversion to homocysteine to methionine in the cytoplasm. So having gone on Charles's advice to the Mass General Hospital to learn somatic cell genetics and the culture of human cells, which even then in the early 70s was considered an art. It couldn't, you know, be done everywhere. I learned the techniques of somatic cell complementation that had been used by the group at Yale and was developed by Littlefield in Boston, and came back and was going to work on folate metabolism. And we started collecting patients from around the world that had elevations of homocysteine at the time, and some had elevations of methylmalonic acid. And I was very fortunate here, because at McGill, things worked from the bottom up, as Charles said. And there was wonderful hematologists, Bernie Cooper and Michael Whitehead, and Bob McKenzie in the biochemistry department, and Jacques Jolivet at that time. And we had folate clubs with beer and bread, and we discussed theoretical things. And McKenzie and Cooper would talk physical chemistry, and I understood about 5% of what was going on at the meetings. And we'd grasp ideas, and we'd collect patients, and we did things. And so in 1986, David Watkins was involved with describing cobalamin G, which turned out to be one of the complementation groups, and then later cobalamin E. And these two groups you'll see in blue, and you'll see the numbers 1984 is when the genes were found, and they're in blue because they were done primarily with Roy Gravel, and because he was bringing the tools of molecular biology, and we were bringing some of the tools of functional analysis and somatic cell genetics, and the patients were important. So for cobalamin E, for example, we knew we had two complementation groups, but we had no function. But finding the mutations was proof of the disease, and that led now to the concept of methionine synthase reductase and the functional studies that are going on. I didn't discover cobalamin A. That was known for a while, or cobalamin B. But with Roy in blue, with Melissa Dobson, a graduate student with him, who was superb in bioinformatics, you really used the early tools of, you know, looking at comparative genomics to find these genes. And again, in these cases, finding the mutations in the patients was proof of the disease. So the other model is use of carefully collected and well-characterized patients, and almost never of the 500 maybe patients we've collected have we made a misclassification of complementation. And that's what allows people to go ahead and do the mutation analysis and actually show that this disease actually correlates with that patient. Again, cobalamin C was described by Hunt Willard and Ira Melman at Yale in the early 70s. Pathology on patients with cobalamin C were actually the basis that Kilburn-McCulley hypothesized the homocysteine basis of cardiovascular disease on the basis of pathological findings, also along with patients with classical homocystinuria. So we were fortunate in having in this century, you know, about 200 patients, and Jordan Lerner Ellis actually did whole genome scans on patients from consanguineous families, and we were able to find the gene in 2006. Last year, with Brian Fowler, we found the gene for Gabalamin D, and this was a very nice story. In 1985, we published in Science a paper that described the accumulation of free vitamin B12 in the lysosome and postulated there was a defect in a lysosomal transporter for vitamin B12. Last year, Isabel Racine-Muis and Frank Roach in Germany, Isabel in our lab, both on the basis of somatic cell chromosome transfer, as Eric had described, and on the basis of looking at individual patients from unrelated families and different ethnicities and finding one haplotype and one mutation, were able to publish this in Nature Genetics last year. And then this year, I'm going to show you a little bit of the data. This is now submitted to New England Journal under second review, where we found the gene for the Cobalamin transporter, the TC receptor. So a nice story. So I'm just going to go very quickly on two things because there's not a lot of time and can't give you much science. But basically, we started with 200 patients with Cobalamin C and then joined hands with Brian Fowler in Basel. We've tried to both collaborate and compete at the same time, which is fun because we have a nice small... People said that the B12 community is a fraternity or, you know, rather than anything else. It's a small group of people, and so we do compete, but we do sort of try to help each other. And now we've had 56 known causal mutations in this disease. But there are common mutations, and very interestingly, mutations are specific to particular geographical areas. For example, the C 271 Dupe A is responsible for about 40% of all alleles in the European and North American population. The C331C to T is a very nice one because you find it in French Canadians and Cajuns, showing the common origins of those two populations. The C440G to A is ones that we've been found in Native Americans, and this C609G to A is the most common mutation in Asians. Recent studies from the lab have started to look with the people at the Genome Center at allelic expression, and you can see that if you look at allelic expression from patients who are wild type, the expression on both alleles will be the same, but if you look at a mild type of the disease versus a severe allele, you'll see that there's overexpression of the allele from the mild type of the disease. And the question is, what is the function? Recently, the Banerjee group has shown that the MMACHC gene product has a decyanation effect where it clips the cyano group off cyanocobalamin. The problem is cyanocobalamin isn't a natural form of cobalamin. Recent work from Banerjee and Don Jacobson's group have shown that it has a dealkylation effect as well, but we still don't really know what the function of this protein is, and we think that it may have a major form activity in terms of shuttling vitamin B12 through the cell. Shun-Wei has constructed a knockout mouse. This is being continued to be work on by Mihaela and Lloyd Majeska, and you can see that very interestingly, very early on in development, most of the minus-minus are knockouts, but you see we have a holoprosencephaly model and also a limb jaw defect model. So this fits in very nice. So now that we have fortification of flour and food with folate and we're getting our folate levels up to normal, should we be looking at B12 as a risk factor for neural tube defects? Last thing I just want to say is in the last few years, newborn screening has changed technologies and people are starting to do tandem mass spectrometry, excuse me, I'll get shot by Bergeron, looking at newborn screening. And it's just showing that when you have a new technology and you get patients being referred to you, and the patients are referred to us because they have elevated homocysteine usually, or in this case, elevated C3 and then elevated methylmalonic acid. So we've found, okay, elevations of MMA in a baby who was normal, but whose mother had subclinical pernicious anemia. So this is finding disease in the mother on the basis of findings in the baby, okay? We found a B baby who was normal, but whose mother had asymptomatic Cobalamin C disease. All right? And finally, we have this new inborn error metabolism where we actually got this cell. We now have about 6 or 7 patients referred to us. Natasha said 7 who were sent to us because of an abnormal newborn screening test for methylmalonic acid. And we started looking, okay, what is it? We did all our tests that looked normal, but we knew that last year, one of my colleagues in downstate New York at Quadros had cloned the gene for the TC receptor. So we'd got these, we'd done our normal tests, signed it out as normal, and then David Watkins had noticed that the vitamin B12 uptake in the cells was a little bit lower, quite a bit lower than what we normally saw. And he did a timed uptake. And we said, this is very interesting. Let's send DNA from these to Ed and let him do some, you know, let him see if he finds mutations. And we then followed up once he found the first one. But almost all the patients had the same mutation. And in fact, there is a mutation in the TC receptor that it is responsible for the phenotype. Well, the phenotype in this case being the abnormal newborn screen. The big dilemma is this disease or is this non-disease? But our concern is that these people may come on later in life with disease, and then how do you follow them? What is the ethical imperatives in terms of following them? And do you label them at this point or not? So if you want sites for references, that's there, and I think I stuck pretty much within my 15.